WBAIN New York. Stick it in your ear.
All right. Thanks a lot.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. A person who I've interviewed 3 times and never ceased to amaze me with all his accomplishments, from being a labor leader to a wonderful writer and collaborator in science fiction, died yesterday, July 17th, 2022, at the age of 75. Last week on this program, I held a little discourse about alternate histories. He was a master of the form. We will hear the first of those 3 interviews recorded at New York City's regional science fiction convention Lunacon during its waning years of 2009. Also, Dan Persons reviews a new movie from Spain, The Sacred Spirit. Stay tuned. Before we begin, an announcement. This Tuesday, July 19th, rooftop readings at Ample Hills in Brooklyn, New York, at 205 Nevin Street in Gowanus, returns with authors Keith R.A. DeCandido, Hildy Silverman, C.J. Farley, and Elizabeth Nunez. The in-person event kicks off at 7 p.m. Eastern. This is a monthly ticketed in-person event that provides 3 or 4 authors reading from their recent works, plus ice cream. For more information, go to Randy Dawn, that's randeedawn.com/bonus/rooftop readings. By the way, Randy Dawn has a new novel coming out and will be our guest on August 1st. Eric Flint may have not have been one of the biggest names in speculative fiction on a mass market basis, but when you consider just how much effect he has had on the genres, he may have been one of the most important. He passed away as recently as yesterday, July 17th. I'll go further into his CV at the start of the interview. So, set your Wayback Machine to April of 2009, and we will begin.
I have been given a distinct honor by being asked to do interviews with the guest of honor, as opposed to the old school guest of honor speeches. And I've done this several times in the past. In fact, Lunacon's going back to when I did it with John Brunner, so that's a little while ago, a few weeks ago. But but you know, having four guests of honor at one con, three interviews, is very interesting. It's even more interesting when it's when the guests are sort of meta guests. They have all worked together in various ways, and probably one of the best collaborators of all time is Eric Flint. I did an interview with David Weber 2 weeks ago, coincidentally.
Yeah.
Completely coincidentally. And, you know, a good portion of that hour-long, 90-minute-long interview was about Eric Flint. And 2 hours ago here, talking with Misty Lackey, Larry Dixon, and, gee, guess who's name came up. And then talking with Jim Minns about publishing and things like that. Eric is an editor, a publisher. I should mention that I work at a listener-sponsored radio station in New York, WBAI. I mentioned that not so much for either self-aggrandization or a way of saying pity me, but we're considered left-wing. I dare say you too?
Yeah.
Just a wee bit, you know. So think red. Think good thoughts about red.
Or bad.
Or bad. Should we start with that? Just by way of... Okay, let's start with that. How does your political activism inform your work?
It's mostly in the way I look at the world and the kind of stories I'm interested in telling in the first place, I'd say. I try not to let my own very pronounced political opinions... Let me put it this way. I'm writing novels. I'm not writing political tracts. Partly that's because earlier stage of my life I did write political tracts. If you add them all together, probably about 5 books worth. So it's kind of like been there, done that. But also, I don't myself like it when I pick up a novel thinking I'm going to be reading a novel, and then I discover that the author has actually smuggled in a political diatribe in the guise of a novel. I don't like it even for somebody I agree with. And I think it's a mistake for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think tactically it's a mistake because you're just going to irritate your audience. And what's the point of doing that? But secondly, I don't think fiction lends itself well anyway to direct political exposition. I could give a long lecture on why I think that's true, but I just think it's true. I think fiction is an excellent way to impart certain kinds of moral and ethical attitudes, but I don't think it's a good way to try to impart direct political viewpoints. And so I don't particularly try. Now, my own attitudes and sympathies, I think, are probably fairly obvious to anybody who reads my books, but that's more in a question of the kind of stories I choose to tell in the first place, what the general themes are, fairly obvious which characters I'm going to, you know, identify with or be sympathetic to, which ones I don't particularly care for, and so forth. But that's a much broader kind of issue. And one of the things that I'm pleased with is that among them, for instance, many fans of 1632 series, there are a number of of officers in the U.S. military, some active, some retired, some I work with, some are friends of mine. And then case of one is a very close friend of mine, Mike Spear, who's wrote the flying sequences in a couple of books. He's got very conservative political views.
David Weber is not a far left winger.
No, no, and David Weber has quite conservative political views, generally speaking. And he and I get along fine.
So, and work together fine.
No, we work together well. So I think I'm going to leave it at that, and I can answer questions or however you want to run it. But
it's your time.
Right? There's no question it informs my writing. It's hard to explain it. I mean, there's as much as anything else. I think it's the kind of stories I choose to write about in the first place. But I'm not trying to use the novels to impart directly any specific political viewpoint that I might have. And partly it's because in order to do it, I'd have to get awfully didactic. And I don't particularly like reading didactic novels. I don't think most people do. So I just announce any point. And one thing I'm not, I think a lot of writers, there are quite a few writers actually who do use their fiction to convey political viewpoints. And I often get the feeling they're sort of frustrated political activists. And that's one thing I'm not, because I did it, you know, for 25, 30 years. So it's not like I don't have to get that out of my system.
Mm-hmm.
And now I write novels. That's what I do.
Do you foresee tossing in, and I think you have occasionally, thrown in political activists as
characters? Oh, no, I will do that.
Because when I ask about how it informs you, I mean that in the broadest sense.
No, you know, obviously, one of the things I've been most pleased about with the 1632 series, I get a lot of fan letters, and the most common kind I get are from people who are not usually themselves blue-collar workers, but who are one generation removed from it. Their fathers were coal miners, or their relatives were often from that part of the country. And they're very heartfelt letters that are very appreciative of the fact that I'm portraying working-class people very favorably and positively, which is not common in science fiction. Actually, it's not common in any popular literature, but it's certainly not common in science fiction. And I take a great deal of pride in that, and part of the reason I can do it is I spent 25, 30 years of my life, you know, in that milieu. So, and there's no question that any writer's life is going to be, you can find it in their writings, if you know where to look. Not necessarily directly. There's only two characters I've ever written that are more or less directly patterned after real people.
Mm-hmm.
But typically, characters, there'll be, you know, a whole range of people that'll sort of inform or, you know, be the model for one or another feature of a character. And it's true, I've included a few novels, not many, but included, there's one character in the 1632 series, Red Seibold, who's a definite political agitator, you know, and it's
right.
Characters I can write about, but it goes broader than that. I mean, I had one person comment to me a few years back, they were struck by the fact that I'm an atheist myself, but I have more religious characters or more religion in my novels than most science fiction writers do, including ones who are themselves religious. And I do that partly because I just think it's part of life, and it always kind of... I remember when I was a kid, I was reading science fiction, and one of the things that irritated me was that there were very few, if any, people of color in the stories I read, and there were no Jews. And I remember thinking, "What did Hitler win the war? What happened?" And I remember as a kid saying, if I ever write science fiction, by God, you know, that's going to change. And I make it a point of including a range of people in my stories, just kind of because that's what the human race really looks like. And that's partly why I include a lot of religion, because the fact is it's a big part of human life. But the other reason is because I don't have a problem depicting characters who do what they do primarily out of, you know, strong religious convictions. Coincided at a certain point to make it not only possible for an author to work alone, but it made it very difficult to work any other way. Now, those of you who are my age and or older and can remember what it was like, when I first started writing, there were no Xerox machines. You want to make a copy of something, if you didn't use a carbon paper, which is a royal pain in the butt, you had to spend a lot of money, go to a photo shop, and have them do an actual photographic, you know, photostat of it, which is extremely expensive. My first typewriter was a manual typewriter. It was a big deal for me to graduate to finally be able to get myself a Selectric. Anytime you made a mistake, and I always made a ton of them, you had to painstakingly correct it with whiteout or this or that. It was just, you know, mechanically writing was a royal pain, and it was hard enough for one person to do it, much less bringing in somebody else, where you had to correct their stuff, too. So there was always collaborative writing. But most of the time, it was married couples or good friends who lived in the same city, you know, and so forth. And there was a limit to it. There was always a lot more of it than I think people realize. Science fiction was always straightforward about it. It became, I don't know why, but the tradition in mystery genre was that collaborators wouldn't publish under their own name. They'd adopt a pseudonym for both of them. So Ellery Queen, for instance, is not... There is no Ellery Queen. He was actually two authors of names. I don't even remember.
The other one.
The collaborative fictional name is far better known than the name of the two actual guys who did the writing. But still, it's limited. Today, it's just about as easy to write collaboratively, at least technically, as it is to write by yourself. Between computers, word processing programs, the internet, emails, it's easy. And I think what we're seeing is writers are moving back in that direction. Not all writers, because some writers are not temperamentally suited for collaborative work. They just don't like to do it. It doesn't come naturally to them. And I was talking to Lois Bourgeon once, and she said the idea of trying to collaborate with anybody writing is just, she can't imagine trying to do it. She never has. She never will. I like it. The one thing I dislike about being a writer as a profession, it's a great job in almost every other way, but it's very isolating. Basically, the way I make a living is I go in a room and talk to myself for 8 hours. And the reason I come to a lot of conventions is actually not for the promotional value, which I think is actually an illusion. I think a writer is going to lose more money in lost production time by going to conventions that you can make back by the value of the promotional work. And I've figured the math. I do it just for my own mental health. You know, it just really, I think it's good for me to get out of the house once every 2 months, go somewhere else, talk to people I don't know. I didn't invent them. I can't predict what they're going to say to me. So that's the one thing I don't like about being a writer. But collaborative writing is a way of making it quite social. And so I collaborate with a number of different authors. All of them have become friends of mine. And I tend to have close relations with my editors and my publishers, in the case of Bain. So it's a much more social and... Part of this is the atmosphere of Bain Books, which was created by Jim Bain.
And I was about to go there.
Yeah, I think Daw may have some of the same spirit. I think it may be the one... I'm not sure. I'd have to ask Missy, but... there's a very definitely a collegial atmosphere at Bain Books among a lot of the authors. One of the things that happens is if a new author gets picked up, pretty quickly one of the more established authors will, or Jim used to do it himself, you know, you'll be tied in with a collaborative work on a novel, or there might be an anthology, you get invited to contribute stories to it. People tend to look out for each other. And I find that's really pleasant and removes a lot of the... I hear a lot of horror stories about publishing and being a writer, and I honestly have to say I have not experienced most of that. Some of it, but not most of it. And some of it, admittedly, is because I was successful pretty quickly, so that tends to, you know, ease the slings and arrows of an outrageous fortune. It really does. I mean, there's no question about it. But some of it is, I think, also just, you know... where I got started and the way it got started.
But Bain Books, aside from the fact that he ran things very differently, I, by the way, worked with Bain at Galaxy Magazine.
Oh, did you?
In the waning days, yeah. Yes. Spider Robinson, Jim Bain, and myself. It was a strange and wonderful atmosphere.
Yeah.
And but Bain not only creates a certain camaraderie and working place and atmosphere, he created the Bain Free Library, which he became the first librarian of. And it's a completely, at that time, radical economic model for distributing books at a time when people weren't thinking about e-books at all.
You know, the interesting thing is, I agree with you and I don't, and I'll explain what part I don't. I think this always used to grate Jim a little bit.
There's a lot that used to grate
Jim. Well, that's true. True. Jim could be graded by many different things. But
and it was fun to do it, too.
Sometimes it was, yeah. The way the Bain Library happened, I'll tell you exactly how it happened, was I got in a fight online. This is about 2000. In the news groups and Usenet, where I had already gotten in a great big huge brawl with a lot of people over the way I edited the James Schmitz reissue. So I was already kind of...
Excuse me one second, Eric. Could somebody go out there and let them know that they are broadcasting almost literally? And if possible, close the door. You may have to prop a chair in front of the door. That won't stay closed.
Anyway,
sorry, go
yeah,
on, please.
I was already getting in lots of fights there. But some jerk, pirated a bunch of texts and uploaded them on the internet. Really, you know, really badly scanned, hard barely copied, you know, terrible quality, but of a lot of different science fiction authors, and boasted that he had destroyed copyright. Well, this triggered off a kind of eruption of fury on the part of a number of authors. And very quickly, I got mad because I understood why they were irritated. This guy really was irritating. But you know, they just, their reaction went completely over the top. And I got pissed. And I happened to be talking to Jim that night about something else. And put up a book of theirs for free online and advertised it, that they wouldn't see any drop at all in their sales. In fact, they'd probably see their sales go up. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, I think you're probably right. You want to try it? Why don't we do it? We'll take one of my books. Let's take my first novel, Mother of Demons. It's been out for 3-4 years now anyway. I said, are you willing? He said, yeah, sure, let's do it. So we put up Mother of Demons the next day, and we had Arnold put it up. There was no, you know, this was just on Bain's own website. And then I announced it in the Usenet. And basically with a great big raspberry. You know, well, screw you, I'll pirate myself, see if I care. And then I thought some more about it, and I called Jim back, and I said, you know, this is kind of an interesting, nifty little stunt, but it actually I think worked better if we did it as a policy. So how about we tried creating like a library? You know, I think he's the one who suggested Bay Free Library. And he liked the idea, so he said, let's call Dave Drake, see if he's in on it. So we called Dave Drake, and he liked the idea, and he agreed to it. So yeah, that's really how it emerged, the three of us. And then within 2 days, me and Dave Drake, and I got a hold of Dave Freer. He was in on it, and a bunch of other authors. That's how the Bain Free Library got started. But to go back to what I was saying, here's the thing about the Bain Free Library that I think a lot of people don't see clearly. It's a stunt. Fundamentally. And that was actually its purpose and still is in a lot of ways, because it's a really flashy way of making the point that we'll give you this stuff for free, completely unencrypted. And that's pretty much proves that all this fears of piracy are baloney. But here's the truth. month after month after month, year after year, and it started before the library, Bain Books has been selling people e-books completely unencrypted for an average cost of $2.50. Which already demonstrated that piracy was bogus because, you know, $2.50 is not much of a speed bump if someone really wants to pirate something. And yet, the you know, it's not just the Bain Free Library. It's the most graphic way of making the point that's clear and it's immediately accessible to people. And because, you know, you put free on something and it attracts attention. It does. And a lot of people, and so you can put it on, I just found out, I guess it automatically comes on an iPhone. So you get the Bain Free Library as part of it. Where you're obviously not going to get webscriptions, even though it's cheap, but you can get the Bain Free Library. So it's an attention drawer. It's a stunt. It's, you know, the man in the flying trapeze and the blip, you know, up in the distance carrying the sign and all that. But honestly, there's no difference between that and webscriptions. It's one of the things I found amazing, and I'm not going to name names, but there are a lot of I'm not because there's no point. But quite a few authors that I've asked if they'd be willing to put some up in a Bain library, they're reluctant, you know. Look, I don't ever push them, but some of those authors have titles that are being sold through webscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say it to them. I feel like saying, you are aware of the fact that the minute you put a book up for sale on webscriptions, whatever piracy you're going to suffer from, you've already exposed yourself. You know, I mean, that $250 is not going to stop anybody if they're bound and determined to do it. But there's a lot of irrationality in this whole subject, and less so now than there used to be. But anyway, that's how it got started. And the thing about the library is you don't separate it out from the entirety of the way Bain's approached electronic publishing from the beginning. The library's part of it. It's an important part of it. But if it were just by itself, it'd be kind of a stunt, very dramatic stunt, but still kind of a stunt. But it's actually just, you know,
it's good business.
It's good business.
It brings people to the web store.
Yeah.
Just like putting something outside your store, you know, putting some fruit outside your grocery store.
Exactly.
Brings people to that grocery store, then putting some things out there, bring people into the store, and they buy things. And it's not going to stop the Usenet people. Nothing will. Because they're going to, even if it's already free, nothing's going to stop them.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. I mean, I've never been convinced that when somebody walks into a brick-and-mortar bookstore and steals a book of mine, they've actually done damage to me. Because not that I think they would have bought the book, the dirty, rotten bums, but the fact that the molecules are not electrons. The fact they remove the book from the shelves means it's not there for somebody else to buy it. And typically bookstores only have one or two copies of any given book year. So months will go by when someone else can't buy that book because it's missing. But that same dynamic does not happen when you're dealing with electronic downloads because, you know, somebody can swipe a pirated edition, but it doesn't mean that the existing legitimate edition's vanished. It's sitting right there. So the question becomes, well, would that person have bought it anyway? And the answer almost invariably is no. First of all, I don't even like the word pirates because the fact is I am convinced that the big majority of people who are taking free copies of things, including pirated ones, are people who simply can't afford to get the real one or the legitimate one. I got an email once from a fan of mine in Malaysia. He said, I'm sorry, I've never bought a book years. It's a month's wages for me. One book. Well, I don't expect anybody to spend a month's wages to buy a book of mine. That's crazy. And I don't begrudge him whatever free copies he can dig up. I mean, it's not like I'm going to get any money from him anyway. And who knows, you know? I mean, you build up a certain fan base in Malaysia, and one of them emigrates to the United States and can, or their income improves over time. Who cares? But why worry about it? It's not like you're losing anything anyway. The same is true in a lot of countries where a lot of piracy takes place. They can't get the stuff legitimately, or their income is too low to be able to afford it, or there are students who can't afford it. So why worry about it? I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to get a hold of some stuff from Australia, which is not available.
You can't do it.
And so, effectively, I can't on my computer, I can play Windows Media Player or something, but if I wanted to show it, Region 4 is not going to play here, so we're going to have to find some way of putting it on a disk, bring it back up, rewriting it, and basically pirating it to show. I would buy it. If I
could
get
it. No, I know. Some years ago when I was in London, I saw a copy of a DVD of Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood, which I really wanted. I bought it. Brought it back to the United States, discovered I couldn't play it.
PAL.
Right. I have since gone back to Britain twice, and I have not even considered buying another DVD, which I probably would have otherwise. I mean, but I'm not going to. Why? I mean, they made it, impossible for me to do it.
Yeah.
No, but see, you've got to understand.
That's not the point.
No, honestly, part of the arguments I get into with people is that it's inevitable. There's a natural selection process of people who tend to participate a lot in online discussions tend to be people who are technically rather educated and proficient. And they tend to think, everybody does this, people have a tendency to project onto the entire human race that they're probably just about like me. And the truth is, the average person, even today with vast computer owners and people using it all the time, they use computers to play games and send emails, and that's it. And the number of people who know how to do any of this kind of stuff, or who are going to be interested enough to bother to learn how to do it, look, I know how to use a computer well enough to make over $100,000 as a writer. I wouldn't know how to pirate one of my own books. I wouldn't. I mean, other than Google. Which I know is, and I've had people say, oh, no, here's how you do it. And they send me, and it's like, I don't even want to know why. It's not that hard to get a copy of a book of mine or someone else's if it's being sold intelligently for a few bucks, legitimately. So why go through all the headache of pirating? Why bother? And yet it's amazing. It's funny. A lot of people seem convinced that people will do anything to get something cheap or free. And yet, toll roads exist and make money every single day, proving the exact opposite. Because there's no place in the United States you can't get to driving free roads. There's almost no place you have to take a toll road to get to. Probably a few islands somewhere. But
that's a wonderful analogy.
But no, toll roads, you can get. I do a lot of cross-country driving because I do research for my books. And I get off the interstates as fast as I can. And I drive county roads and state roads and U.S. highways because it's a lot more interesting. And you can get anywhere. You don't have to pay tolls. And yet tolls make lots of money. Why? Well, because people are generally, they're in a hurry to get somewhere and they're willing to pay a few bucks to take what's usually a faster, quicker way to get there, rather than waste their time, which is what it's going to take otherwise, because there is no such thing as a free lunch. And whatever else crime is, it's also work. Thieves work. They do. Thieves don't get what they get for nothing. They actually have to go out and work. I mean, they have to plan it out and encase the place and sneak in and creep around, and it's work. And they're not going to do it if the amount what they're going to get from stealing is not worth the amount of work they've put into it.
With 10 minutes left, I'd like to change the topic. Your reissues.
Uh-huh.
I'm a huge James Schmitz fan, Keith Laumer, Murray Leinster, all these people that you've worked to reissue.
Good.
And as an editor and publisher, you have, aside from being a writer and collaborator, you've done a great deal to enrich today's world of science fiction, the things that I was reading in Ace Books and Ballantine and all that, which go out of print in a horrifically short period of time. You've made sure it's still around or around again.
Yeah, as much as I could. You run into problems. Some estates you just can't work with. you know, I have had Jim Bates' agreement to do. I wanted to do a major reissue of Kuttner and Moore, but we couldn't work with the estate. Eric Frank Russell, same problem. Clifford Simic, same problem. So what I wanted to do was reissue, especially the authors I grew up with. I mean, you know, it's partly... It's not an accident that if you look at the authors I reissued, they tend to be authors who were prominent in the 50s and 60s. Authors prior to that, I just didn't grow up with them, and most of the really good ones were already reissued anyway, and I figured the authors that came later, somebody else will worry about them. Part of what happens to writers is that if somebody doesn't do a major reissue of their work, the danger you run, and it's one of the reasons I really hate modern copyright laws with these incredibly long terms of protection, is that when an author's fans die, then the chances that he or she is going to get reissued drop pretty drastically. Because for any generations after that, it tends to be kind of academic. They may abstractly know that this author was important, but they didn't grow up with him. There's not a real close emotional tie. And if you look at the history of how literature keeps getting revived, and keep in mind, most authors vanish. I mean, and they just do. It's just the way it is. And it is, I've reissued a half a dozen. That means there are probably 600 I didn't, and I won't. But you try to get the ones that you think are the most important, or at least are most important to you. And if you let too much time go by, then you break the continuity of the memory of the different generations. And at that point is when you see authors just kind of completely vanishing. So I wanted, if I could, to get at least a half a dozen of the authors I grew up with that some of them I grew up with it really important to me. I wasn't worried about it. Robert Heinlein keeps getting reissued. Andre Norton keeps getting reissued. Arthur Clarke doesn't have to worry about it, you know. But it was that next tier of authors. It bothered me that James Schmitz went out of print a lot. That was the one that bothered me the most. But I didn't like the fact that Chris Ramble, I couldn't find him. Laumer was a little bit of a different thing. I was never a Laumer fan myself, but Jim Bain owned the Laumer estate, so he wanted me to do it. Jim Bain basically supported Keith Laumer the last 10 years of his life. For those of you who don't know, Laumer suffered a terrible stroke in his mid-40s. He lived another 20 years, but and I'm an expert on Laumer's writings because I'm going to wind up reissuing 11 volumes of them. Laumer's writings break simply into pre-stroke and post-stroke, and everything written after stroke is not worth reading. You know, it's kind of amazing he was able to write at all. But it all reads like somebody, a third-rate imitation of Keith Laumer is what it reads like. It's got all the vices and none of the virtues. I'm not actually that fond of Laumer. He's a writer I can abstractly admire, but I've never warmed up to him much. But Jim supported him the last 10 years of his life because he kept giving him books. And the funny thing is, Jim didn't like him. Nobody liked Keith Laumer.
He was a difficult man, from what I understand.
The term you run across more often is monster. I've never been able to get someone who knew him alive to agree to write a preface. I called up Fred Pohl, who was one of his main editors, and asked Fred, you know, if he'd be willing to write a preface. And there was silence on the other end of the phone for a few seconds. And Fred said, you know, Eric, I really, really, really detested and loathed that man. So I don't think I'm going to do it. Joe Haldeman was his last friend, and I asked Joe. And Joe wouldn't do it. And then he told me why. The last encounter he had with Laumer, I was like, oh, Christ. I'm not going to tell you. It'd take too long. But, yeah, Laumer was not a likable guy. And Jim didn't like him any more than anybody else did. But he just felt he had been important to science fiction. He didn't like the idea the guy just...
He may not have liked Laumer. He may have liked
his
chief.
What he would do was he would keep sending him money to write books that either never got written or... One of the weirdest books ever published. I don't know how many of you have ever seen it. It's by Keith Laumer. It's called it's got a weird title, like Chrysanthemum, but not quite.
Oh.
And if you read it, what it is it's excerpts from a lot of different Laumer. It's as if you went into a movie, paid $15, sat down and watched trailers for 2 hours. That's what it is. It's just excerpts of Laumer stories. So it's the weirdest book you'll ever see. And I asked Dave Drake, I said, why did this thing ever get published? And Dave said, I don't know. I imagine Laumer needed $20,000 and some Jim... And couldn't write it all anymore. And Jim said, I'll tell you what, we'll put together a thing, and here's $20,000.
Some of Sheckley's post-block work was a little like that,
So anyway, when Laumer died, I think he owed, the estate owed Maine Book something like $250,000. And so what happened was Jim just agreed to take the estate. And so when I approached him after the Schmitz reissues happened, I said, I'd like to do more of these. And I named some authors. Laumer was not one of them. And Jim said, well, Eric, he says, the problem is I own the Laumer estate. And I'm feeling guilty that I've never done anything with it. I just wouldn't feel right reissuing any other authors unless I could find some editor who'd be willing to reissue Laumer for me. So anyway... I said, all right, Jim, I'll do it for you.
You're still doing these?
Yeah, although I'm coming to an end because there will be one more Christopher Anvil volume, and then the title of which is The Power of Illusion. That will put back in print everything Anvil has ever written in science fiction up to this day. Now, he's still alive. He doesn't write much anymore, but actually I bought a story for him for the anthology. So, it's conceivable he might write one or two more stories in his life. But basically it'll be the complete works of Christopher Anvil. Complete works of Jay Schmitz is out. Leinster, that ended because partly they weren't... The first book, Medship, sold pretty well. The next two didn't. And then the estate fired their existing agent, which was Barry Maltzberg, and got a new agency, and the new agency screwed around, and finally we just said, oh, the hell with it, so we let it go. There's going to be a second book of Howard L. Myers, and that will reissue all of Myers' work. He's not a well-known author. He's a terrific author, but his career only lasted 4 years, and he died of a heart attack at the age of 41. But a wonderful author. I'm trying to think who else is on that list.
Currently.
Who I got currently? Laumer's got, yeah, Garrett. Jim didn't like Garrett, to be honest. And he was willing to do the Lord Darcy stories because he thought they'd sell really well. But when I approached him to do more Garrett, he just didn't want to do it. And it wouldn't sell, so it's just a question of he didn't want to do it, so it wasn't going to happen. I think we're running out of time. But I'm about done because the problem is that the estates that are left that I'd like to do, I can't.
Yeah, I'm shocked about the Simak thing. I interviewed him, and he seems like a person who would like to have seen his stuff continue out there.
I'm sure he would have, but the guy who controls the estate is just a little too hard to work with.
Yeah.
And the thing about reissues is they don't make much, if any, money. Part of the problem is estates often have inflated ideas of what they're worth. They can do well, but the estates have to be willing to cede quite a bit of control to the publisher. I think a lot of times it's control issues you run into. Mm. And whatever the reason, the guy who controls the Simak estate was not willing to give Bain enough that it made it worth it, and so the deal just fell through. Then the people who control the Russell estate are just flat crazy. And the people who control the agency that represents Kuttner Moore, I'm not going to say they're flat crazy, but they're so hard to deal with that. And this is not just my experience with them. I remember when I mentioned to Mike Resnick, he says, oh, Christ, them, So that's part of the problem. And then the other side of the problem is a lot of authors I'd like to reissue, but they're just simply not well-known enough. I might be able to reissue them in electronic book form.
That doesn't have a high overhead.
Yeah, Tony and I have talked about doing that. So might be able to start doing some reissues in electronic format. But the truth is the only authors big enough in my generation I think would work as big paperback reissues Hank, are you back there? Who am I overlooking? Well, one other big one that Bain's doing, which I sort of engineered, but I'm not doing it, and Hank's actually editing it, is the there's a complete reissue of all of Paul Anderson's, you know, the whole... what's that thing called, Hank?
It's called the Technics League.
Right, yeah. It starts with the Polysotechnic League and Nicholas Van Ryn and all of Dominic Flandry. Bain's reissuing that whole thing. So we're doing other things I'm not directly involved in. Hank's doing that one. Hank did the call court. By the way, this is Hank Davis in the back there. Hank, stand up, will you? Hank is...
there you go.
Hank is a very flamboyant, as you can tell. Hank, is it true that you once had a business card printed up that described your position at Bain as utility infielder? Anyway, Hank is the staff member who does lots and lots of different things. He's the guy who writes the blurbs. He does a lot of the editing.
And he's written some decent short fiction.
And has written some short fiction of his own, yes.
That's
right.
But Hank, what I was going to ask is, outside of Kuttner Moore, Eric Frank Russell, and Clifford Simic, can you think of any major authors of that 50s-60s period that we haven't reissued? Or the some are, and obviously we haven't, you know, some of them are.
Sheckley?
I'm sorry?
Gordon Dixon. Nearly all his stuff except your side stuff. But he's handled by the same guy.
He's handled by the same guy he handled Simic. Yeah, I know. Now, Sheckley, that's an interesting... Who
handles Sheckley?
Well, a lot of Sheckley stuff may be imprint. Who handles Sheckley?
No, it isn't.
I don't know. Was able to do Sheckley.
Well, but see, that's a different issue. I've noticed, I don't quite know the reason, but I've noticed before that sometimes a small press, like NASPA in some cases, can do, like they did an Eric Frank Russell reissue.
Yes, they did. They also did Corduaner Smith.
We were also able to, Corduaner Smith, that's controlled by, that's VC Nonsense, isn't it? Ralph Vizianes is a professional agent. He's fine. He's easy to deal with, if he can reach terms. But for some reason, some estates seem willing to let small presses put out one volume. And I think, I'm guessing, but I think the reason is it's a control thing. You know, you can sort of let a small press do something, and you still, you know, run the estate. But the truth is, if you hand the rights to an estate over to a major publisher like Bain, on the terms we're going to want it, and the terms when I do one of these reissues, what I want is the right to the whole estate. I want the whole kit and caboodle. And then what we do is put in the contract to protect the estate that if we don't produce a book every 18 months, then whatever we haven't reissued
reverts
to them. So we can't just sit on it. But I want to be able to, you know, and part of the problem you run into, this was the sticking point with Simic's estate, was, well, we want you to tell us all the books you're going to do and what's going to be in each one. And I said to him, well, first of all, you're asking us to guarantee you we're going to do multi-volume reissue. We can't because we want to see how the books are going to sell. But leaving that aside, I'm the editor of the series. You're asking me to put in about 500 hours of unpaid labor
before
you are maybe willing to sign a contract. And I said, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. I don't make money doing this. I make my money as a writer. And I maybe probably break even on this editing work. And I do it just because I want to do it. But I'm not going to do that. And some estates are, you know. And now I think of some, you know, Dave Freer and I and Misty wrote a sequel to Witches of Carries. And Dave and I are now writing a sequel to that. Misty dropped out because she had other projects. But the next book will be called Sorceress of Carries, and that's coming out in January of next year.
Great. We're past time, but I gotta say I love those books, and I am so pleased. Schmitz should have written sequels to the Carries books.
Well, the thing is,
short story too, they didn't count.
He started one, but. And there's always been a rumor floating around that one person, one prominent fan who went by the moniker of Garland of Edor claims that he saw it. But Schmitz himself said he never wrote it. He had notes put together. But then the deal fell through with the publisher. And then he lost the notes in the course of a move, and that was the end of it. We did, when we did that first sequel, we went right back to the ending of Witches, picked right up from there, and we tied up all the loose ends that he'd left in it. And Dave Freer wrote the first draft. What he did was he sat down and he typed the first 50 pages of Witches of Kerry just so he could get a feel for Schmitz's, you know, the way he, you know, as best he could, the flow and the way he'd use language and so forth. I mean, within the limits of what you can do, you're never going to get it quite the way the author would have done it. I think we did a really good job with that. I'm pleased with that book. Anyway, yeah, we are over time.
Yeah, we're way over time, but it's been a pleasure doing it. And thank you for your writing, your collaboration, your editing, and everything.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I dare say Eric Flint was one of the most fascinating people I've ever met. There are many books, standalones, and series that he has written, and I thoroughly recommend them. Next, Dan Persons reviews a new film from Spain.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. In the new Spanish film, The Sacred Spirit, which will be available on Blu-ray on July 19th, the twin sister of a young girl, Veronica, played by Lum Arquez, has gone missing. The gossip around the city of Elche, where the film takes place, is that she is the latest victim of a band of organ traffickers operating out of Turkey. But the girl's uncle, Jose Manuel, played by Nacho Fernandez, may have a better understanding of what's going on. He's a member of a group of amateur ufologists and has something of a fascination for Egyptology as well, and also knows that those who took Veronica's sister now have plans for the girl as well. And I'm being very cagey with that synopsis, because while The Sacred Spirit appears on the face like your standard SF thriller, that's not actually where writer-director Kema Garcia Ibarra, making his feature film debut here, is going. He's dubbed the genre he's working in domestic science fiction, taking the trappings of science fiction, conspiracy theories, and spirituality, and cross-fertilizing them with real-world social issues, particularly economic ones. It's a fine line he's walking between genre and non-genre here, but I think he qualifies by creating a just slightly left-of-center reality, where the characters interact with a restrained, almost dreamlike attitude, the eye of Horus is omnipresent, and television sets run on continuous loops of oddly, spiritually themed advertisements. In one case, an author insists that businesses existed on Earth before the evolution of humans. The director also achieves a more surreal atmosphere through the roughness of his production, shooting on location on 16mm, casting non-professionals as his actors. It makes for a strange, low-key yet compelling mise-en-scene, definitely connected to our world, yet also venturing one step beyond. I had my choice of several films to cover for this review, and while The Sacred Spirit is the dodgiest in terms of whether or not it's actually genre, it's also the one I couldn't easily dismiss. The press materials for the film invoke the likes of Ken Loach, Aki Kaurismäki, Yorgos Lanthimos, and Pedro Almodovar in talking about Ibarra, and the director himself mentions Louis Buñuel. And those wild swings in attempting to characterize the film are not only all apt, they're also an indication that Ibarra can't quite be pinned down, that he is his own unique voice. Certainly with The Sacred Spirit, that voice has made a striking debut. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
You have been listening to Hour of the Wolf, My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks on August 1st with guest Randy Don. In the meantime, stay tuned for Night Shift. And tomorrow, the 9 p.m. art strip continues with Cat Radio Cafe. Good evening.
This is the mic check for Cat Radio Cafe.
Testing.
Testing.
Tune into Cat Radio Cafe Tuesday night at 9 here on WBAI.
I'm Janet Coleman.
I'm David Dozer.
The Displaced Playwright on Tuesday, July 19th at 9 p.m. will be joined by artist and curator Mark Kehoe to extend an open call for an upcoming exhibit at Revelation Gallery at St. John's in the Village called Framing the Village, an exhibition of West Village and East Village art.
Tuesday night at 9. Here on WBAI.
Cat Radio Cafe.
Hey, do cats drink coffee?
When you're not looking.
Better check the security camera.
My name is Dan Ingram, and I'm a WBAI fan. They've always been, you know, the station that kicked butt and the station that said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that. I have to
celebrate you, baby. Extinction Diaries. Based on what we now know, releasing flying or floating balloons should be outlawed. Animals mistake broken pieces or entire balloons for food, but the balloon chokes the throat, stomach, or digestive tract, causing pain, and the organism slowly starves or drowns to death. And some balloon victims are already endangered or close to extinction, like dolphins, whales, and sea turtles. Birds get their beaks and bodies hopelessly entangled in balloon ribbons and bunches of broken balloons. They also eat pieces of balloon, and like plastic that lodges inside of them, the result is a painful death. Also, similar to plastics, balloons can travel thousands of miles, if not the entire planet, and even biodegradable versions can take as long as 7 years to break down. Conservationists and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agency strongly oppose balloon releases. 5 states and many cities now have laws banning or restricting balloon releases, and though more bills are being introduced, a complete ban on balloons is what needs to happen as fast as possible. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World radio production.
Yeah, bunks on rungs.
Can't talk, got a beat in my headphones.
I'm Linda Perry, program director at WBAI, and I've got a beat in my headphones telling me to update you on phase 2 of our Tower Fund Drive. Tower Fund Drive, what's that? Oh, well, it's a push to raise the $17,000 a month needed to pay the space at 4 Times Square, which houses WBAI's transmitter. Can't you get some grant or some large funder to take care of that so you don't need to ask listeners? Good question. But no, we are listener-sponsored and non-commercial, so that's why we come to you for support. Unless there is some big funder out there that we could approve of, that would be great. Anyway. Anyway, where are we? We raised $125,000 in phase 1 of the Tower Fund Drive, and now phase 2, that's what we're in, we raised another $35,000. So we're caught up with back rent until May of this year. Now we owe June and July. We always owe something. So we owe June and July. Our goal is to raise $17,000 by the end of July. Can you please help? And if you haven't donated before, can you donate now? Go to towerfund.wbai.org and contribute what you can. Or please go to 212-209-2222. 2950 and tell the call center you want to contribute to WBAI's Tower Fund in the name of your favorite program or in the name of all WBAI shows.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Breathe deep.
Breathe deep.
Expand your mind.
And let the music be your driving force.
Enter a world of color and light.
And keep on thinking free.
The most eclectic mix of music in the city that never sleeps at 99.5 FM.